If you happen to believe in the existence of a God, then there is a difference between you and I. But this is really a small difference. Over the centuries and millennia, most people have been believing in thousands of gods. You don't believe in almost any of those gods, and I don't believe in any of them. I just believe in one less god than you do, and that's really a small difference.
Welcome to Reasonable Faith, Conversations with William Lane Craig. I'm Kevin Harris, and we hope you'll find the topics we discuss enriching and enlightening concerning the big questions of life. Dr. William Lane Craig is a noted philosopher and theologian known for his work on the existence of God, philosophy of time, and the resurrection of Jesus. And we invite you to discover the wealth of resources at reasonablefaith.org. There you'll find Dr. Craig's famous debates with leading atheists, articles, books, podcasts, audio from Dr. Craig's Defenders class, and a question and answer section featuring amazing questions people send us and answers from Dr. Craig. That's reasonablefaith.org. reasonablefaith.org. Really rollicking debates have been going on, Dr. Craig. We want to talk about those, beginning with one at the University of British Columbia, Vancouver, with Dr. John Shook, and it was on the question of, does God exist? Let's talk a little bit about Dr. Shook, and then we'll talk about this debate, which has some very interesting aspects to it.
Yes, it really did. It was a fun debate. Shook is a philosopher from State University of New York, and he is a very strong naturalist. In preparing for the debate, I visited his website, and he has a very sophisticated account of naturalism there with, I forget how many different varieties, something like 11 different sorts of naturalism, very elaborate taxonomy or categorization of different sorts of naturalism and which one he would defend and so forth. So it seemed to me that one could construe our debate over the existence of God as a debate between naturalism versus supernaturalism. And so that was what I decided to do, was to try to frame the issue in such a way that it would be supernaturalism versus naturalism. And I would challenge Shook to support his naturalism, because on his website, he had really bad arguments in favor of naturalism. And I felt that I wanted to make him bear his share of the burden of proof to try to show why naturalism is true.
And so, naturalism is the view that there's nothing beyond nature. We've discussed it before.
That's right. That nature is all there is. I think the definition he gives is something like the contents of the space-time universe is all there is, or physical reality is all there is. That's one of the definitions of naturalism.
Makes no room for God or anything.
Certainly that's clear. Whatever definition of naturalism you use, there's no room for God in a naturalistic worldview. And so that would be the key issue between naturalism and supernaturalism.
By the way, I noticed that a lot of your debates are framed as a question. Does God exist? Did Jesus rise again from the grave and so on? What are the advantages of debating a question as opposed to a resolution of, it resolved, God exists?
When you have a resolution, then the person who takes the affirmative has to bear the burden of proof, and all the negative has to do is play the role of the skeptic and say, you haven't proved it, you haven't proved it. But if you have a form of a question, then both sides have to give their answer to the question, and therefore both sides have the burden of proof to support why their answer to the question is the correct one. And so by stating it in the form of a question, it makes a level playing field between the two debaters.
It seems to be more productive to debate that question.
Well, I think it does help to bring out both sides better, whereas if you were simply debating a resolution, you would have an affirmative case, but then you would never have any negative case. You would just have refutation of the affirmative case. But I think students want to hear pro and con on an issue, not just pro and why the pro doesn't work.
Now, this was the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, and that is Richard Dawkins territory. Very low church attendance.
Yes, the whole Pacific Northwest in the United States as well as in Canada is very secularized. I think only 3% of the population in Vancouver attends church, which is astonishing. That's like Europe. That's even worse than some European countries.
Is there European influence, you think?
No, actually, I think it would be more Oriental.
Okay.
From the Pacific Rim countries. Canada has lots of immigration from the East, as well as from India and South Asia. So there's a lot of people from other ethnicities in native Canada that are in the area.
So this is what you were going up against, an audience that was really going to be stacked against you.
Right.
It usually doesn't play out in a formal debate in that everyone is to be orderly and ask their questions. And this one played out a little differently, though, as I understand.
Yes, that's right. The moderator of the debate in this case was the student president of the debating society, and he encouraged students to express their agreement with a speaker by rapping loudly on their desks. Well, this created just a raucous atmosphere in the room, so that every time Shook would make a point that these atheist students like, they would pound their desks and applaud.
It's logically possible that there's a flying spaghetti monster out there as well.
And so the whole thing took on more the appearance of a circus act than an academic debate.
Seems like that would be a little, you know.
Yes, it is, because you see students applauding points that, to my mind, were absolutely doofus kind of points that he was making. He would say things that had no basis and really no relevance sometimes to the debate, and it would bring a huge round of reaction from the atheist students. And it was just surprising to me sometimes the kind of feedback they would give. And on the other hand, the Christian students in the room were less numerous and were also much more timid or perhaps polite. And so they were not making a similar ruckus when I would make points. They would be relatively quiet until later into the debate, and then they got into a little bit more. But as a result, it did kind of give the impression of a sort of one-sided audience that he was really making all these great points and really scoring big hits.
Well, it would give the impression that he was winning the debate.
Yeah.
You know, because of audience response. Well, yes. That depends on the makeup of the audience.
Sure.
One of the things he said is, when you gave the arguments for the impossibility of an infinite past, he got up and said, this just shows we shouldn't consult mathematicians about what exists. And the students broke out into applause.
Yeah, and I thought, why would they applaud that line? We shouldn't ask mathematicians about what exists. But what was especially ironic about this was that it was I who was claiming that the mathematical use of the infinite has no ontological implications. That is to say, in plain language, just because you can use the infinite in mathematics doesn't mean that the infinite can exist in reality. So what he was saying was actually supportive of my side. And yet, somehow, you know, nobody got the point, at least when he said this. In fact, there was a pattern that emerged in the debate, Kevin, that was very odd. He says that as a naturalist, we depend upon reason, science, and experience to give us the truth. And yet in the course of the debate, the only person that was appealing to arguments based on reason, science, and experience was me.
Yeah.
And he kept backing away from reason, science, and experience. For example, backing away from what mathematicians have to say by saying, well, we shouldn't ask mathematicians about what exists. Backing away from what reason says in this case.
So when
and
you
he
studied
did the same thing with experience, with history as well.
Okay. When you studied his website and you saw that those were his three criteria of sorts, you realize that your 5 points that you were going to make satisfied that. And so that's the direction that you went.
Yes, exactly. I realized that I was appealing to reason, science, and experience to prove the existence of God. Whereas Dr. Shook either admitted, he was somewhat inconsistent here, he either admitted that you cannot prove naturalism, you can't prove that the natural world is all there is, or else he gave an argument that was just patently invalid to anybody who understands logic. He would argue in this way. We know that nature exists. Look around you. We see nature exist. We know nature exists. Premise 2, we cannot prove that anything beyond nature exists. That's his belief. Three, therefore, nothing beyond nature exists. We know nature exists. We cannot prove the existence of anything beyond nature. Therefore, nothing beyond nature exists. Well, that's just a non sequitur. It doesn't follow. That's like saying we know gold exists on Earth. We have no evidence that gold exists anywhere else other than Earth. Therefore, gold only exists on the Earth.
There's no gold on Pluto.
Yeah, yeah, there's no gold anywhere else in the universe. I mean, it's just crazy to think that you could reason in this way. And yet this was his argument for naturalism. So, I mean, wholly apart from the fact that his second premise was false, that we don't have any evidence that something exists beyond nature, my arguments, I think, showed that we do have evidence for something beyond nature. Even if you grant both of his premises, it doesn't prove that there isn't anything beyond nature, which is what you would have to prove naturalism. And yet this is a sophisticated philosopher. And I was just shocked that he would give a patently invalid argument in support of his view.
I see from the newsletter here, and by the way, I want to encourage people to read the newsletters that you put out, that they're there on reasonablefaith.org. From the newsletter, an account of this debate, and his response to you on the resurrection of Jesus was, are there any extra-biblical corroborative writings, any extra-biblical, anything outside of the New Testament that corroborates this?
Yeah. In other words, he would not deal with the primary source documents, which have been collected into the New Testament. He just asked, well, is there anything outside the New Testament? And the presupposition here, which is very common among laymen and students, is that the documents of the New Testament are somehow not to be trusted. But if we have documents outside the New Testament, that's real evidence. And what they fail to understand is that originally there wasn't anything called the New Testament. Originally, there were just these separate documents in the Greek language, like the Gospel according to Luke, Paul's first letter to the church in Corinth in Greece, the Acts of the Apostles. These documents in Greek, handed down out of the first century, telling this remarkable story of this man, Jesus of Nazareth. And it was only a couple of hundred years later that the church collected these documents together and put them under one cover that today we call the New Testament. But when the historian looks at the evidence for the historical Jesus, he doesn't treat the New Testament as a single inspired book. He looks at it as what it originally was, just a bunch of separate documents coming down out of the first century telling this story of Jesus of Nazareth. And the question he asks is, are these documents reliable? So that you can use the historical methods to approach these documents and to find out whether or not these primary sources are reliable in what they say about Jesus of Nazareth. And the question about secondary literature that is outside of what the church eventually collected in the New Testament becomes quite secondary. Most of these sources, well, really all of them, are later derivative accounts that already know the New Testament and therefore are not the primary sources. And it would be mad as historical methodology to ignore the primary source documents in favor of exclusively looking at secondary, derivative, later documents.
That's exactly what he's saying, though. Dr. Shook is saying, I'm going to penalize your New Testament, so you're going to have to show me something outside of that. Well, why is he penalizing the primary documents? That's the question.
He's already begging the question by assuming they're unreliable, isn't he?
And they pride themselves in that. Often, the skeptic, when they throw this at you, as saying, oh, we're trying to avoid being circular. You have to show me something outside.
Yeah, and that's a complete mistake. When the modern historian examines the documents of the New Testament, he is not assuming that they're reliable and then proving the Bible by quoting the Bible. That would be circular. Rather, what he does is he treats these as he would treat the writings of ancient historians like Herodotus and Thucydides and Tacitus, and asks, as he asks of those writers, are these writers reliable in what they say?
Do you recall his responses then to things like the beginning of the universe and Big Bang cosmology?
As I recall, again, he simply backed away from Big Bang cosmology by just saying how uncertain all of the scientific evidence is and how provisional it is, and we don't really know. And so we're the, in other words, again, you see what I mean? Rather than following reason, science, and experience, he would try to undermine what reason, science, and experience tell us, which I found very paradoxical.
Well, this shows that this was almost turned into kind of a sporting event rather than a debate. It's kind of rare among the debates that you've had. How did you adjust your presentation, or did you at all?
I don't think I did try to adjust, Kevin. There's not much you can do when you have a hostile audience other than simply debate the issues. I think in the Q&A time, I may have confronted the students at a point or two by saying something like, I'm puzzled that so many of you applauded this point because it is patently invalid, or those of you who applauded this point apparently don't understand the way New Testament historians work. So I may have attempted to be a little more confrontational by pointing out that their applause on certain points was quite misconceived. Well, but apart from that, I just stick to the issues and try to show why his arguments don't work and why my arguments haven't been refuted.
Well, you're in good company, because many presidents of the United States have had to make the same point, whether they're on the campaign trail or even in office. Richard Nixon, very bravely, I believe it was in South America, encouraged students to debate rather than to throw rocks and to shout down their opponents.
Yeah. In this case, I have to say, on behalf of the students, they did not attempt in any way to shout me down or interrupt my speech. All of the desk banging and applauding was during Shook's speech. It was more like the Oprah show or the old Phil Donahue show. Whenever somebody made a point you liked, boy, the audience would applaud and go wild. And they would just be silent if the opponent made a point and they didn't agree with it.
Well, this is kind of strange, because he said, in response to your argument for design based on the fine-tuning of the universe, Shook said, if the universe weren't fine-tuned, then maybe other forms of life would have evolved. And then everybody erupted in applause at that.
Yes, they did. They thought this was really scoring a deadly blow. And what they didn't understand is that in the absence of fine-tuning, not even matter would exist, not even chemistry, much less galaxies or planets where life could form. So it's just, again, Kevin, ignorance on the part of the students of what these issues are about. They don't understand the fine-tuning of the universe. And I would expect that ignorance among students, but it's disheartening to see this among professors who are willing to get up in front of hundreds of students and debate these issues, that they are so ignorant of the problems that are involved.
We really have this temptation, all of us, to root for our man rather than to root for the truth. We ought to be open to our opponent if he is able to shed some light on something. We ought to be grateful, you know, but that's yes. That's just not our attitude.
It's not. And that's true for Christians as well, that they want to root for their man as well. But I think that there's a great deal to be learned from these sorts of exchanges about very profound and interesting questions of the nature of morality, the origin of the universe, the person of Jesus. And I would hope that some folks, at least, will come away from these having really been stimulated to think about these issues for themselves and maybe to begin to explore them.
Thank you, Dr. Craig, for spending some time with us, and thank you, the listener, for being here today. This podcast is available at reasonablefaith.org, as well as a wealth of audio, video, and written materials from William Lane Craig. People all over the world have benefited from the insights of Dr. Craig, and we invite you to browse our resources at reasonablefaith.org. And when you give to Reasonable Faith or purchase our resources, you help us expand into more media and speaking events, taking Christ to a world of big questions. So be sure and visit us at reasonablefaith.org. I'm Kevin Harris. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll see you next time on Reasonable Faith with William Lane Craig.